This is number 17 from Rudolf Steiner, Selected Talks and Meditations, called Staying Connected. The meditations given by Rudolf Steiner to connect with the dead were not given arbitrarily. Each, though having a general application, arose from his own particular experience of the specific needs and circumstances of the moment. Similarly, whenever Steiner gave a burial or a cremation address, which he often did, and spoke verses uniting with the dead, these too arose from the experience of the moment. Steiner rarely spoke personally about such matters. In the following lecture, however, he does give some indication of how, in specific cases, his connection with the dead occurred. As a background to the meditations, these indications are invaluable. The Importance of Self-Knowledge in the Life After Death, given in Berlin, February 22, 1915. First, let us recall all those who are at the front in the great arena of contemporary events. Spirits of your souls, guardian angels, may your wings bring our soul's prayer of love to earthly human beings entrusted to your care, so that, united with your might, our prayer may stream full of help to souls who seek for it in love. Let us recall, too, those who, because of these events, have already passed through the gate of death. Spirits of your souls, guardian angels, may your wings bring our soul's prayer of love to those human beings of the spheres entrusted to your care, so that, united with your might, our prayer may stream helpfully to those souls who seek it in love. This evening I would like to offer some thoughts concerning knowledge of the relationship between our physical world and the spiritual world, which I will connect to somewhat more private events within our own movement. Such a thing is possible, of course, within an intimate, closed circle like this. I know, above all, that I must be ready to accept responsibility for these statements to those who were our fellow members during their physical lives, and who will remain so in their next lives, and who bear some relationship to the facts I want to speak of today. Several weeks ago, my dear friends, as brought to pass by karma, I was asked to speak at the cremation of several cherished friends, since I happened to be staying in the region where this cremation was taking place. Another element was involved as well, for it was directly suggested to me that I might receive certain remarkable impressions concerning the existence of these individuals in the spiritual world, since they had passed through the gate of death only a few days before. I have often said that whether one receives impressions of this or that fact of the spiritual world depends upon a variety of factors. Above all, it depends upon how possible it is to form a true inner connection, a strong inner connection with the souls concerned. It may be that at times one operates in the belief that a very special relationship must be established with this or that soul, yet such is not always the case. With many souls, what is experienced soon makes one realize that such a connection is in fact not so difficult to achieve after all. Now, my dear friends, in the three cases I would like to speak of now, the most intense need arose to receive impressions concerning the very being of these souls directly after their death. I would like to state that in these cases the urging arose all by itself. To be sure, one can certainly talk about a great variety of things at a funeral service, but in these three cases the inner necessity arose to establish a vital connection with the being of the souls in question, to somehow clothe in words the essence of these souls during the course of the cremation ceremony. It was not, however, as if I had exactly intended to characterize the inner being of these particular souls at the service, but rather this emerged as a need for clarification, for illumination. I certainly do not wish to say that it must be so in all cases, but in this instance the impulse to characterize the essence of one of these souls after death actually came to me from the spiritual world, not as a spiritual law, but as something I personally experienced. I had no need to choose the words appeared, the words came. And we will see later, my dear friends, just why this was so, for several indications can be given about the further life of this particular soul after death. For all this to be properly understood, I must first make some comments about the special nature of such experiences. When we wish to receive impressions here in the physical world, we place ourselves directly in the presence of things. We construct thoughts according to how we see, hear, or feel things. We know that it is we ourselves who create these thoughts. However, when we have to do with a soul who has passed through the gate of death, we notice at once that all we ourselves create, be it in thought or in word, actually distances us from the being in question, that it then becomes necessary to give ourselves over completely to what is forming itself within us. In order to describe these impressions in words, we must have the inner capacity for allowing the words to create themselves in us, for we ourselves can contribute nothing to the process whereby they are actually revealed. We must be able to listen inwardly to the words. And when we do so, we come to know with certainty that these words are not spoken out of one's own self, but out of the being who has passed through the gate of death. We must be able to listen inwardly to the words, and when we do so, we come to know with certainty that these words are not spoken out of one's own self, but out of the being who has passed through the gate of death. That was the case when several weeks ago an elderly member of ours departed the physical plane here, an older member who over many long years had deeply and wholeheartedly settled herself into our movement, and who brought to life in her feeling and in her warmth the kinds of ideas and concepts that our spiritual science can offer. With enormous devotion, this individuality identified in her soul with all that works and weaves throughout our spiritual science. It now became a matter of somehow surrendering oneself to the impressions proceeding from this soul. And, remarkably, a few hours after her physical death, certain words in fact arose, not just word impressions, but actual audible words which expressed themselves in a manner characteristic of the departed soul. The only possible response to these words was simply to offer one's very best effort to interpret clearly what the departed soul was speaking from its innermost being. For one must certainly call such communication speaking. And those were in fact the words that I spoke at the cremation. They were not my words, as I said, but those, and I beg you to consider carefully the words I use now, which issued from this particular soul who had passed through death. Into cosmic distances I shall bear my feeling heart, so that it may be warmed in the fire of the sacred powers. In cosmic thoughts I shall weave my own thinking, so that it may become clear in the light of life's eternal becoming. In depths of soul I shall dip devoted contemplation, so that it may become strong for the true goals of human striving. In God's tranquility I shall strive through life's struggles and cares, preparing myself for its higher self, seeking the peace of joyful labors, sensing cosmic being in my own being, thus I would fain fulfill the duty of being human. Then I may live in expectation, going toward the soul star that gives me my place in the spirit realm. Then, speaking the words again at the end of the funeral oration, without intending it, I felt compelled to revise them so. Then may I live in expectation, going toward my star of destiny that gives me my place in the spirit realm. Well, it was clear what this was. It was an attempt by the particular individual to so impress into her own being all that she had taken up throughout the years of spiritual scientific thought, ideas and sentiments, that these ideas, these sentiments, could become forces to shape and mold her being after death. So this individual made use of the ideas and conceptions of spiritual science in order somehow to inscribe, to imprint her own inner being in such a way that it could then truly progress spiritually in the world beyond death. Shortly thereafter we lost another friend of our movement, another member from the physical plane, and again the great need was present to define this member's essential being. But it could not be done as it was in the previous case. In that instance, I was fully able to say, because of how the words were formed, that a soul who had passed through the gate of death was expressing what it was feeling and what it wished to become. It was articulating itself. The second case was such that I had somehow to place my own soul in the presence of the soul in question and spiritually observe it. Then that soul, too, proclaimed itself, but it spoke in words which actually drew the material for its self-characterization out of the observing soul itself. Thus what the soul of the deceased did there provided an impulse to express what I had now come to feel about that being, now that it had passed through the gate of death. And the following words arose, which I then had to voice at the cremation ceremony. You stepped amongst us, and from the quiet power of your eyes, the trembling sweetness of your being spoke. Serenity, ensouled and alive, flowed in the waves with which your glance would bear your inner weaving to people and things, and this being ensouled, your voice with eloquence. More by the nature of the word than in the word itself, revealing what lay hidden in the beauty of your soul, and revealing too, wordlessly, the devoted love of sympathetic listeners. This being of noble, silent beauty announced the world's soul creation to hearts perceptive and receptive. Thus, with the speaking of these words at the beginning and the end of the funeral address, the cremation began. And it was actually possible to observe, my dear friends, that at this moment, that is to say, not the moment of the spoken words, but rather the moment when the heat of the oven took hold of the body, there occurred a kind of first instant of consciousness after death. What I mean by instant of consciousness is this. Immediately after death, a review takes place of what appears in the etheric body as a life panorama. However, this passes away after several days. In this case, it became necessary to have a fairly long delay between the time of death and the cremation, during precisely that special time of the panorama. Death occurred at 6 o'clock on Wednesday evening, and the cremation did not take place until the following Monday at 11 o'clock. Thus the pictures of the life tableau had already begun to fade away. Therefore, the first moment of any real consciousness following the panorama occurred when the heat of the fiery oven embraced the body. And in that moment it was very clearly demonstrated that the manner of perception, the whole way of perceiving the world for such a newly become spiritual being, is quite different from that of the human soul while it is in the physical body. In the physical world we perceive things in space as remaining stationary when we ourselves move away from them. If I perceive a chair that is standing here and then move a bit further away and look around, the chair is still there. I can look back at it. If I go further, the chair still remains there. It stays where it is. This is not true for events which play themselves out in time. These events, passing by us in time, do not stay put. An event that has happened to us is gone, and when we look back at it, we can do so only in memory. Only our past connects us with the event. This is not so for the spiritual being. It sees the events as remaining there, just as here we see things in space as remaining there. Such was the first impression that the soul I have been speaking of had of the burial service and all that was said and done there. The service had already been over for some 5 or 10 minutes, but for the deceased it was still there. It remained there as only things in space remain for physical human beings. And the first conscious impression was the looking back upon what had been spoken there, and most of all upon the words which were now resonating, upon the words that I have just read. What Richard Wagner said out of deep intuition is really true, quote, time becomes space, unquote. That is, what is past is not past in spiritual experience, but remains there as things remain in space for physical human beings. And so the first conscious impression after death was of the service and what was spoken there. This case was such that I could not call the life review and the contemplation of what had occurred during the burial ceremony an ultimate illumination of consciousness, for afterward the twilight state, which I am going to speak about, set in again, and only after some time did the consciousness light up once more. Once again, slowly and gradually, illumination of the consciousness returns. It takes months for it to be complete enough so that we can say that the deceased is now completely surrounded by the spiritual world. But later, precisely through this later brightening of the consciousness, the intense need arose within the individual to look back upon this first moment over and over again and fix it clearly in her eye. And, as I will explain, this is in total harmony with what can be known about the whole behavior of the human being after death. A third case, one that will touch our dear Berlin members especially deeply, is the instance of our recently deceased friend and fellow member Fritz Mitscher. Fritz Mitscher entered death's door shortly before the completion of his 30th year. He would have been 30 years old on February 26th. When I turned my thoughts toward Fritz Mitscher's being after his death, impulses arose above all in my own soul, the observing soul. These proceeded from his very intense dedication to our spiritual movement. He was in this regard an altogether exemplary individual, exemplary in the sense that while his nature tended toward scholastic achievement, he developed more and more out of a deep inner need the capacity to place all the learning he strove to acquire in the service of our spiritual scientific movement. Thus he was precisely one of those individuals who are so essential to the progress of our spiritual scientific worldview. This is greatly needed in the present day, so that external scientific endeavors can be made use of by the soul in such a way that they stream into the knowledge gained from the spiritual world with which we so concern ourselves. And that quickened the youthful soul of Fritz Mitscher. Thus one has to feel, having also observed him here during his life on earth, that he is on a very, very proper path in regard to our movement. Our friends will remember something I said years ago on the occasion of another death, that individuals such as this, who have passed early through the gate of death, after having to a certain extent taken into themselves what physical science is able to offer at the present time, prove to be significant co-workers after death for our spiritual movement. Our movement is assuredly not dependent solely upon those souls who remain here in the body. If we did not have the strength of souls who have passed with earthly knowledge through the gate of death and remain connected with the power of will that streams into our movement, we would most certainly be unable in this present materialistic time to maintain the hope, which we must cherish in sufficient measure for it to be truly justified, that we will progress further. Thus something proceeded then out of Fritz Mitscher's soul that no words can express other than those I wish to read to you now, which I also spoke at the cremation. A hope, delighting us. You entered the field where earthly flowers of the spirit may be revealed to the seeker through the power of soul being. At the root of all your striving lay the purest love of truth. To create out of the spirit light was the profound life goal you ceaselessly strove for. You nurtured your beautiful gifts, unconfused by cosmic contradiction, the true servant of truth. On the bright path of spirit knowledge, you turned your steps. You practiced your organs of the spirit courageously and stubbornly, so that they pushed away error from both sides of your path, giving you the space for creation of the truth. You were forming your own self to reveal the purest light, letting the sun force of the soul shine powerfully within you. This was your life's joys and cares. Other cares, other joys hardly touched your soul, because cognition of the truth seemed to give life meaning and a value that was real. A hope, delighting us. You entered the field where earthly flowers of the spirit may be revealed to the seeker through the power of soul being. Painful loss, most deeply felt, you now vanish from the field where the earthly seeds of the spirit ripened in the womb of soul being, to become awareness for the spheres. Feel our loving gaze directed to the heights where you are facing now, a new and different task. From those high spirit realms, lend your strength to those who you left behind. Hear the prayer of our souls. There speaks our truth and faith. To fulfill our task on earth, we need powers great from lands where spirits dwell. Strength that comes from friends who have died. Hope, delighting us, painful loss deeply felt, let us hope that in far nearness, never lost to us, you will guide our lives as a soul star in the spirit realm. End of the quote. Such words, my dear friends, have been so shaped that they must be viewed as arising out of identification with the soul which has gone through death. These words, even when not articulated by the soul itself, even when only a suggestion issuing from the soul, emerge through the forces which come forth from the soul, as a demand to be repeated precisely, down to the very last one, just as they had been given. I had absolutely no other words in mind than those that I have just read to you. Afterward, something I found extremely startling happened to me. during the night following the funeral, the soul of Fritz Mitscher, not yet communicating out of his consciousness, but certainly out of his being, made a kind of response to what had been spoken at the funeral. The following words came from this soul which had passed through death. I was forming my own self to reveal the purest light. Letting the sun force of my soul shine powerfully within me, this was my life's joys and cares. Other cares, other joys hardly touched my soul, because cognition of the truth seemed to give life meaning and a value that was real. End of that quote. It did not occur to me in the least when I was writing these verses down that each you and your could be changed into me and my. They simply came alive for me. Quote again, you are forming your own self to reveal the purest light. Letting the sun force of the soul shine powerfully within you, this was your life's joys and cares. Other cares, other joys hardly touched your soul, because cognition of the truth seemed to give life meaning and a value that was real. End quote. The words had now actually been transposed in that way, which they could be without any need to alter a thing grammatically, so that you yourself and, quote, streams inwardly to you mightily, unquote, become, quote, me myself, and, quote, streams inwardly to me mightily, and so forth. So we have here a remarkable connection between what had been spoken here and the soul who had gone through the gate of death, a connection that demonstrates how what had been said actually came back out of the soul, not as a simple echo, but instead altered to a certain extent in its meaning. I would also like to observe that, as these words were expressing themselves, a certain feeling actually passed through my soul that set a basic tone, like an urging, making me feel a kind of obligation to give the soul a special mission as it passed through the gate of death. We know, of course, how much opposes our spiritual movement in today's materialistic time, how little the world today is suited for this spiritual movement, and when one comes to what it is possible to accomplish in an earthly body, let me read that again. And when one comes to see what it is possible to accomplish in an earthly body, one can truly say that help is needed. And it was this feeling which found its way to expression in the words, quote, hear the prayer of our souls. There speaks our truth and faith. To fulfill our task on earth, we need powers great from lands where spirits dwell, strength that comes from friends who have died. Thus, end quote, thus calling upon the soul to use the seeds which it had acquired here for the further advancement of our spiritual scientific movement seemed to me to be necessary and appropriate in this particular case. So we now see in these three cases of people so close to us that in spite of all the differences, something similar obtains. The similarity is that within the observing soul, strongly impelled through karma to observe, because it had to speak at the cremation ceremony, thoughts were stimulated about the inner being of these three souls. And therefore the need arose to speak, to articulate this inner being. Concerning the first individual of whom I spoke, you know, of course, in what spirit I say these things, only to serve understanding, not in any way to flatter myself. I had actually come to know her on the physical plane as well, after she had joined the society. One, indeed, witnesses certain things that take place while individuals are here in our society, but our friends will know that it is not my custom to make any particular inquiries about the life situations of specific individuals, or ask about what they have experienced during their physical lives here. So it was less for my personal satisfaction than for the sake of understanding that I characterized this personality further in a small funeral address, how she had lived out her life here on earth according to the nature of her soul. In this I had nothing before me except the soul after death, not just the words that the soul had expressed, which I read at the beginning, but the actual soul as it was with its unique characteristics after death. I had nothing else before me. I really knew very little about what had happened to her before she joined our society, and also not especially much of her life here, apart from meetings, and such or those other occasions when I now and then have contact with our members. I knew nothing more. Nevertheless, in this particular case, I felt myself obliged, as if in obedience to an inner demand, to speak at the funeral about certain life situations, certain relationships which had had a bearing upon her whole life, and she had lived to an advanced age. Her relationship with her children and to her work in life, and, as I said, I did not feel a personal satisfaction, but rather the satisfaction of having gained understanding when her relatives said to me, that they had really and truly recognized this particular individual from what had been said there, for every word characterized her perfectly. Thus a picture of an individual life during the course of physical existence had been formed by observing the condensed results of that life after they had been drawn together in the soul. What is especially interesting for our understanding, however, is that in this soul we perceive the intense need after death to concentrate one's spiritual gaze upon one's own life. Now, it is certainly not to my credit to be able to characterize the personal life of this particular individual. Rather, the process was such that although the individual was not conscious at the time, she nevertheless directed her soul being, directed those forces which would later become conscious, upon her own life and her own experiencing, thereby preparing herself for her later conscious life after death. And what I was made to say could be seen in the thought pictures which arose as she directed her soul toward her own experiences. Therefore it fell to me to describe what the individual was unconsciously thinking about herself after death. What is important to us about this, what needs to be emphasized, is that the individual after death felt this intense need, unconsciously, to direct her gaze upon her own being. With the second individual, who had to some extent been awakened as the heat took hold of the body, this need showed itself later in her uniquely characteristic conduct during a kind of sporadic reawakening. As I mentioned, she had the need to somehow reach back to turn again to her own inner being and to the words which had been used to characterize it. And indeed in the speech, if one can call speech what expresses itself in the relationships between souls, whether in the body or already spiritual beings, already dead, to the extent that one can speak of such communication, I must truly say that when I was able to witness a later reawakening of this individual, I sensed a kind of joyful feeling that I had been able to express those words which had revealed themselves to me. And thus it was shown that there had really been a true working together with the dead. One can understand from this that the soul of this person, figuratively speaking, of course, expressed itself somewhat in this way. It's good that this is here. It's good that this is in this place. Such a feeling revealed itself in the second awakening, as if the deceased were showing that a kind of strengthening is provided there in the spiritual world through this expression in human words here on the physical plane. It was for her something that she needed, and it was therefore good that through the physical earthly word it became more fixed than she herself was able to fix it. That is to say, the need existed in her to make this fast, and it was a relief to her that it had been strengthened in this way. In the case of our dear friend Fritz Mitscher, we can see very clearly that in the night following the cremation he directly connected with and made use of what had been said here in order to make his own being clear to himself, in order to bring himself to true comprehension of his own being. Thus, in all three cases, we have a contemplation of the individual's own being. Unquestionably, such things move our souls and our hearts, above all because of their purely human value, their truly human significance. But we gain spiritual knowledge from the real world only when it wishes through grace to offer itself to us. We cannot compel it. We must await it. And it is precisely through such things as these that we can see how remarkable karmic relationships work. One day after the second of the individuals referred to had died in Zurich, I myself was in that city. We were passing by a bookshop, and I noticed a book which I had read years before. I believed the book was still in my so-called library, but that was in such disorder due to my custom of living in many different places in unusual circumstances that it would not have been easy for me to find it there. Indeed, perhaps it was no longer in my library at all. In any case, years before, I had read the book by the Viennese philosopher Dr. Ernst Mach, and now a second-hand copy was for sale right there in the bookshop. I wanted to read it again, or at least look through it. On the third page, something came to my eye which I had lost sight of long ago, namely a most interesting observation by Ernst Mach concerning human self-knowledge, about the difficulty of self-knowledge for human beings. I quote almost word for word from the notes on page 3 of the, quote, Analysis of Sensations, unquote, by Ernst Mach, university professor, quote, "Once as a young man I was walking along the street and happened to encounter a person about whom I had the feeling, 'What an unpleasant, obnoxious face this man has.' And then I was not a little shocked to discover that it was my own face that greeted me, looking back at me from out of a mirror." So he had been, unquote, So he had been walking along the street, and a mirror located opposite him had cast his own reflection back at him. And as he saw himself, he thought, "What kind of man with such an unpleasant, obnoxious face encounters me here?" And Mach immediately adds another similar observation concerning our inadequate self-knowledge. He writes, quote, "I was returning one day, tired from an excursion, and got on a bus. I noticed another man enter opposite me and thought, 'What a dilapidated schoolmaster is boarding here.' And then I saw that it was myself. The mirror in the bus had shown me my own portrait," unquote. And Professor Mach then adds, quote, "Thus I knew my professional image better than my actual one," unquote. That is something like a pointing finger, how truly difficult real human self-knowledge is in contrast to our purely outward form. One has no idea how one appears in three dimensions, even when one is a university professor, as can be seen in this very candid example. It is indeed interesting that precisely this illustration can be applied in our three cases, for it demonstrates that lack of self-knowledge need not be too great a hindrance to what human beings have to accomplish in the physical body here on earth. One can be a famous professor and still have as little self-knowledge as the man has expressed. But I mention this example because it is remarkable that it came to my attention out of physical life just as the soul is being guided anew to take a notice of how the deceased feels the need to understand, to examine its own being. That is to say, here in the physical world we can actually get along well enough without self-knowledge, for as far as the purely material dimensions of our lives are concerned. However, understanding of the spiritual world cannot be gained without self-knowledge. For wholly external material circumstances, one can manage without self-knowledge. But as soon as the soul is passed through the gate of death, self-knowledge is absolutely the primary thing that it requires, and this is shown in particular by the experiences I've presented. Self-knowledge is the starting point from which everything else must proceed. You see, the materialistic thinker is usually stuck on the question of whether or not consciousness actually remains after death. However, spiritual research reveals that after the soul has passed through the gate of death, it suffers from no insufficiency of consciousness at all. Instead, it actually has too much consciousness. That a kind of awakening occurs only later is not due to the fact that one needs to acquire a new consciousness after death, but because one has too blinding a consciousness already, too much consciousness, which must first gradually be reduced. Human beings have too much consciousness, an overwhelming consciousness, after death, and must first somehow orient themselves in this world of overpowering awareness. And to the degree that they actually succeed in this, they become less conscious than they were before. They must first diminish their consciousness, as we must subdue sunlight when it is too strong. So the task one faces is a gradual restraining of consciousness. Therefore we cannot speak of an awakening as in the physical world, but rather of a recovery from the superabundance of consciousness to the degree that it becomes bearable, depending upon what we have experienced here in the physical world. In addition, something else is necessary. To be able to find one's way around in this deluge of light consciousness after death, self-knowledge as a starting point is essential. It is essential that we be able to look back upon our own being in order to somehow find the guidelines needed to orient us in the spiritual world. Lack of self-knowledge is the true hindrance to consciousness after death. We must find our own self in the overflowing light. And now we can see why the need arises to characterize the dead in order to aid them in the process of finding themselves. That is revealed to us as a kind of universal knowledge through such intimate and moving experiences. After death, after the etheric life panorama has disappeared, a gradual development takes place whereby we come to know our own concluded life on earth, which we perceive gradually dawning out of the spiritual worlds. For once the panorama is over, that is our sole task after death. We will be surrounded completely by what exists in the spiritual world. But what we must come to know first of all is our own being. And to this end, ideas come to us for our very great benefit that we can know only from spiritual science, because they give us the means to orient ourselves. Thus we can see that what arose as self-criticism in our first case was made possible only through what that soul had received from spiritual science. She was able so to contemplate her own being that these words could emerge, quote, "In cosmic thoughts I shall weave my own thinking, so that it may become clear in the light of life's eternal becoming," unquote. What the soul is applying here to the characterization of its own being has been distilled out of all that is offered in spiritual science. or, quote, "In depths of soul I shall dip devoted contemplation, so that it may become strong for the true goals of human striving," unquote. However, our real desire is that these things be used to raise our spiritual scientific movement out of the merely theoretical and into something of living comprehension for the soul, a kind of moving stream in which we truly exist and weave and have our being. Then we will know what is taking place all around us in the spiritual world, just as we know that all around us in the physical world is the air we breathe. This is indeed possible, even if it is denied by the uninstructed. It is the future destiny of humankind to know in some measure that just as the air exists for and around the physical body, the spiritual world is all surrounding and can be experienced by the soul. And just as the air interacts with the body, the spiritual world interacts with the soul, forms the soul, weaves the soul, penetrates it with its essence. It is in fact possible for us to indicate in detail the destiny of the soul after death in individual cases. And I would like to say such things will be even more intimately set forth in our time, precisely because, through the momentous and grievous events of the present, death is directing its breath throughout the world, and our age demands unnumbered victims. Thus a special challenge arises for us in dealing with the issue of death in our present day. So, my dear friends, we know that the human being, in passing through the gate of death, gives the physical body over to the earth, to the elements of the earth, and that the astral body and the eye withdraw from the physical body. We have seen in our second case that at the end of cremation, the etheric body had already been laid aside as well. After some days, the etheric body departs. Now, so many human beings in the present day are passing through the gate of death in the fullest bloom of life that we are endlessly concerned with one particular question. We can ask ourselves this question by transposing a purely physical concept into the spiritual, where it obtains far more than in the physical. What happens to the etheric body of one who has passed through the gate of death once it is separated after some days from the physical body? How does such a young etheric body fare? A person who moves through the gate of death at the age of 35 or 30 or 25 or 20 or even younger sets aside the etheric body, of course, but it is an etheric body which could still have served physical life for decades, which would still have possessed strength for decades. As dictated by karma, the use of these forces is denied the deceased, but the forces remain in the person nonetheless. Here in physical life they would have been able to function for decades more. The physicist thinks correctly that here on earth no energy is lost. It is transformed. In the land of spirit, this is truer still. The forces of a youth fallen upon the battlefield here, which could still have maintained a physical life for decades, do not pass simply into nothingness. They abide. And now we can say, prompted precisely by the events of our time, that these forces pass over into the being of the folk soul of that particular people. These forces of the etheric body are taken in by and act within the whole folk soul. These are true spiritual forces which continue to exist aside from the human being, aside from what is born in the eye and the astral body and the individuality throughout the time between death and the new birth. What this really means will best be understood only in the future, that within the folk soul these forces too are present, that they are active as forces, not as beings, within all that this folk soul will unfold. And I would like to add, they will be the most faithful, they will be the most fruitful, the most sun-radiant forces there. Here I would like to offer another example which is close to us. It may at first seem to have little to do with the events of the time, but the manner in which it occurred and what resulted from it can nevertheless give us an insight into all those instances when an unconsumed etheric body is put aside after death has brought conclusion to a youthful life. In autumn we experienced the passing of the 7-year-old child of one of our members. The death of this child happened in a most singular way. He was a lovely boy and an unusually spiritual child for his age, a lovely, good, and very spiritually aware child. Well, he met his death by being in a certain spot at precisely the instant when a furniture truck overturned, crushing him so that he was suffocated, at a place where probably no truck had ever driven before or since, but only at this particular moment. Moreover, one can ascertain by objective fact that this child was in that place at precisely the time the truck overturned, because of a variety of circumstances which are called accidental in the external materialistic view of the world. The boy was picking up some kitchen utensils for his mother, and had left a little late on that particular evening because he had been delayed. Had he gone 5 minutes earlier, he would have long since been past the spot where the truck overturned. Furthermore, he left by another door than was ordinarily his custom, just this once by another door. Had he left by the usual door, he would have passed by the truck on the right. The truck overturned toward the opposite side. When one truly follows this whole case from a karmic, spiritual, scientific point of view, one can completely confirm that the rational logic that one employs correctly in the outer physical world is bankrupt and useless here. I have often used another example to illustrate this further. The example of a man who is walking along a river and falls into the water at precisely the spot where a stone is lying. External observation will naturally assume that the man stumbled over the stone, fell into the water, and thereby met his death. The obvious conclusion would also be that he drowned. But if an autopsy were to be performed, it would be ascertained that the man had suffered a stroke, and because of that had fallen into the water dead, that he had in fact fallen into the water because he was dead, not that he was dead because he had fallen into the water. Cause and effect have been mistakenly reversed. We find such judgments in science at every turn, where cause and effect are confused. That which seems to be established by logic in external life can be utterly false. Thus, using external observation, the death of little Theodore Feiss could, of course, also be described as an unfortunate accident. In truth, however, the karma of the child was such that, to put it plainly, the eye ordered up the truck overturned, so that the child's karma might be fulfilled. And here we have a particularly youthful etheric body. This child, too, could surely have become a man and could have lived to be 70 years old. The forces in the etheric body, which would have sufficed for 70 years, passed to the gate of death after only 7. All this played itself out in Dornach. The father was in the army and was not present when it all occurred. He, in fact, died shortly thereafter from wounds received in the war. This whole event took place in the immediate vicinity of our building, and since that time we have had in the aura of the Dornach building the forces of the etheric body of this child. And anyone who has work to do for this building and is able to perceive the spiritual forces that preside over it finds the forces of this child within. Thus, quite apart from the astral body and the eye that passed over into the spiritual world in order to work in the life between death and rebirth, the etheric body remained behind and united itself with the entire spiritual aura of the Dornach building. Such insights are bound up with deep, meaningful feelings, for they are not ideas to be dryly received as if they were numerical constructs, but ideas to be received with a loving, thankful soul. And so, bearing such knowledge in mind, it goes without saying that when I myself have something to do for the Dornach building, I never for one instant allow myself to lose sight of the fact that these forces are working with me, that these forces are helping me. Thereby theoretical knowledge unites itself with real life. My dear friends, keeping such knowledge in mind, while countless unfulfilled etheric bodies here on earth are passing through the gate of death, will help us clearly imagine now what will happen when the Sun of Peace rises again after the dusk of the present war. Then these forces, these etheric forces of those who have passed through the gate of death, the gate of suffering, will truly be present and will seek to unite themselves with those souls who are working here on earth for the progress and the well-being of the world. However, for this to happen, there will have to be people on earth who have understanding for these things, who can be conscious of the fact that above in the spiritual world, within those etheric bodies left behind, are those who made their sacrifice to the time. They wish to work here on earth, but their labors can truly bear fruit only if there are receptive souls here who wish to unite themselves in thought with what comes to them from out of the spiritual world. So it is eternally important for the fruits of this, our great but difficult and painful time, that a spirit-affirming knowledge bring forth thoughts which can unite with the thoughts descending from the etheric bodies of the deceased. Thus we must receive from these trying circumstances, which stand in the sign of suffering and death, but also in the sign of greatness, the exhortation that they lead us to a higher time, more inclined toward the spiritual than the past time has been. It must not come to pass that those who have sacrificed themselves in order to work for the progress of the earth and its well-being have to look down upon a world in which they find no chance to become involved, because the souls are not there to send back to them the receptive thoughts they need. For this reason, we must grasp spiritual science as something living and as something that is necessary for the time which will come about precisely because of the events of our day. And that is what I have summed up again and again in the meaning and the spirit of our thinking with the words, quote, out of the courage shown in battle, out of the blood shed in war, out of the grief of those who are left, out of the people's deeds of sacrifice, spirit fruits will come to grow if souls with knowledge of the spirit turn their mind to spirit realms. Translated by Thomas Earhart. That is the end of part 17.